Last October, I was working on a writing project away from the office, and because of that, typed the writing that I was doing into a laptop computer for which I do not have a printer. And so in order to get a hard copy of what I had written, it was necessary to bring it here to the office and make a transfer, plug it into a wire in my office to the central computer, and then use the printer there to get that hard copy. The day I decided to do it was a day that I had a number of other commitments, and so I came in quite early in the morning, long before the office was open, and went into my office, plugged in the laptop, turned it on, and then typed in the various commands in order to make the transfer. When I saw all the words on the screen, I pressed enter and waited for it to happen, and nothing happened. So I concluded that I'd made some type of an error in the commands that I'd given or in some step in the procedure. So I went through it all again, taking great care for accuracy, and again, there was no response. So I took out the instruction sheet, took a pencil, and checked off every single step to make sure that I was doing it exactly right. Now, I'm not sure whether it matters always on these commands, whether they be capital or lowercase letters, but I did it exactly as in the instructions. And when I was sure that I had it exactly right, I again pushed enter, and again, there was no response. So I did it again and again and again, making sure that I had followed every bit of the instruction, that every word was exactly what it should be. For 2 hours, I repeated all of these commands, and every single time, and I lost track of how many times, there was no response at all. No transfer took place, and therefore, no printing of a hard copy. In a mixture of frustration and desperation and 4% anger, I gave up, and I left. Later that day, I had a conversation with Mike Clevin, who, in passing, mentioned to me that the wire at the other end wasn't plugged into the church's central computer. I was connected to nothing. Now, I should have known. I mean, I don't know a great deal about computers, but I should have been figured out that when all the right words were in and there are no results from all the commands that I gave, obviously there's something wrong with the connection. Now, it's the same principle that applies to people. Applies to people who say all the right words about being Christians, but there are no results. And that's at least an indication, a sign, that there is no connection to the God whom they claim to be connected to. Now, that is the teaching of 1 John chapter 2, verses 3 through 6, to which I invite you this morning. If you have a Bible, I'd like you to follow along the reading of it. And if not, in the note sheet, you will find printed there the words of these four verses. But I first would like to explain to you something about the structure. For in these four verses, there is a great truth twice told. The great truth is stated in verse 3, and in the end of verse 5, and in all of verse 6. And then sandwiched between these two statements of the great truth are a negative example in verse 4 and a positive example in the first half of verse 5. So, the first statement of the great truth is in verse 3. We know that we have come to know him if we obey his commands. And the negative example in verse 4, the man who says, I know him, but does not do what he commands, is a liar and the truth is not in him. And then the positive example in verse 5, but if anyone obeys his word, God's love is truly made complete in him. And then a restatement of the great truth. This is how we know we are in him. Whoever claims to live in him must walk as Jesus did. These verses, of course, are talking not about computers, but about that which is far more significant and far more important, because these verses are talking about human beings, and us in particular, our lives, and whether or not we really know God and whether or not we are connected to him. The thesis of what here is being taught is that we can know. We can know for sure that we know God and that we are connected to God. Let's try to understand that better for an example in the great truths that are here taught. I admit to you that I've got to do a little bit of kind of complicated explaining. I'll just do that briefly, and then we'll get into some other things that relate to it. There are here two issues that are being addressed. Issue number one is about persons who are Christians but have some doubts, and they'd like to know for sure. They would like some hard evidence that they really do know God. The second issue that is here being addressed is people who claim to be Christians, but who in fact do not behave in a way that is fitting to their claim. The great truth for issue number one is that we can know for sure. We know that we have come to know him if we obey his commands. The great truth for issue number two is that claiming to be a Christian is not enough. This is how we know we are in him. Whoever claims to live in him must walk as Jesus did. Now, to adequately explain this, we need to have a brief bit of review of some Greek history and philosophy. There were, in the first and second centuries, people called Gnostics, a silent G in the front, spelled G-N-O-S-T-I-C-S in the plural. They got their name from the Greek word gnosis, which is the word for knowledge. Interestingly, it's a word that somewhat has come over into English because we refer to agnostics. In Greek, if you put an A in the front of a word, it's called an alpha primitive and it makes it a negative. So an agnostic is someone who doesn't know. The Gnostics claimed that they knew, that they had inside knowledge on how you can know God. And they taught that if you get enough of this knowledge in all of its various levels, you will eventually not only know God, but you will reach perfection. And they had whole complicated procedures in order to make this happen. They had classes, they had books, learning, teaching. They even had special plays that you were admitted to only on the basis of the level that you had already attained, so that you could then grow up until eventually you had all the knowledge that you needed, you would be perfect, you would have salvation, and you would reach God. However, there was no connection in their teaching between knowing and behaving. So, as you got the information, there was no requirement that there be any change in behavior. In fact, you could behave in a most evil way and be said to have reached perfection and know God as long as you had all of that information. Now, tragically, Gnosticism began to creep into Christianity and into the teaching of the church. So there were those who claimed to follow not only Gnosticism, but the teaching of Jesus Christ and the Bible. The way they explained it was that as you got more and more knowledge about God and about Jesus and about salvation, you would go up these rungs of the ladder until you would have perfect knowledge. You, in fact, would be perfect. You would have salvation and you would know God. But it didn't matter how you behaved. You could do absolutely anything as long as you had the information. Unfortunately, Gnostic Christianity, at least in its practical outliving, did not die out in the second or third century. But it has lingered on in one form or another all the way down to the 20th century and shows up often even in conservative Bible-believing churches. For there are people today who say, as long as you have the facts, as long as you have the information about Jesus Christ, that he is God's Son who came in human flesh, that he lived a perfect life, that he died on the cross, that he rose again from the dead, that all of this is for our salvation, that he ascended back up into heaven, as long as you have the information, the facts, it doesn't make any difference at all how you behave. You can do absolutely anything and still be a Christian. But not so, says 1 John chapter 2. We know him if we keep his commands. This is how we know we are in him. Whoever claims to live in him must walk as Jesus did. That causes us to question, what commands? And what does it mean to walk as Jesus did? Well, the commands are the commands that Jesus himself gave and that are listed on the pages of the New Testament. The greatest of all, and in a sense the Bible teaches, one that includes all of them, is the command to love our neighbors as ourselves. That we are to love as God loves, as Jesus loved, and we are to obey that command. There are, in addition, some negative specifics. We are not to hate. We are not to be jealous or envious. We are not to sow strife. We are to avoid dissension. Drunkenness is forbidden. We are not to be involved with Satan or the occult. Teachings of Jesus in the New Testament that are specific commands that are to be obeyed as an evidence that we do genuinely know God. And as far as walking is concerned, walking as Jesus did, that speaks not, of course, of literally walking, that we somehow mimic his step. But rather, it is saying that we relate to God and we relate to one another in a lifestyle that is reminiscent of the lifestyle of Jesus Christ. For example, if you are an employee of a privately held company and your boss is the owner of that business, after not too many months or years of employment there, you probably get to know very well how the boss operates and how the business is to be run. Sometimes in great detail as to how telephones are to be answered or which vendors are in favor and which ones are in disfavor, when checks are to be cut and what are the general procedures of the company, until you get to know how the boss runs the company quite well. The boss, of course, may then go away for some extended leave, perhaps a trip around the world, or maybe because of an illness, cannot come into the office for months at a time. But you and the other employees of the company know how to run that company, at least generally, and sometimes quite specifically, because you remember how the boss behaved. And so you behave in a similar way and run the company that the boss owns the way the boss would run the company if the boss were there. And so it is that someone who is a Christian and says that he or she knows God is to walk or behave as Jesus behaved. Although Jesus is not physically here to be observed, we through the Bible and through experience have come to understand how he behaves and how he operates the business of our lives, which he in fact now owns. And we, in his absence, may not have every detail and specific down, but we have a pretty good picture of what that behavior includes. The great truth is that we know that we have come to know him if we obey his commands, and whoever claims to live in him must walk as Jesus walked. Now, from that great truth, the author of 1 John moves on to the negative example in verse 4, writing that the man who says, "I know him," but does not do what he commands, is a liar, and the truth is not in him. Now, that is a sad but frequent example. If you follow the polls of people like George Gallup or George Barna or some of these others who test the religious beliefs of Americans, you know that upwards to 98% of Americans say that they believe in God, that a high percentage say that they are Christians, that on any given Sunday morning, approximately 41% of the American people are in some type of church or synagogue service. And yet, while there is a high percentage of people who say they know God, it is observable that many of them do not obey his commands. It is in a sense that they are referred to in another New Testament reference in Titus 1:16. It says, they claim to know God, but by their actions they deny him. Every Sunday morning I go through a routine, a ritual that is habit to me by now. Before coming to any of the services in this room or walking up on this platform, it is necessary for me to get wired. Now, what that includes is a microphone that is on my tie. Doesn't that drive you crazy when I do that? And the wire for this comes down through my shirt, goes through my pants, and comes around to a transmitter that I wear on my back. And then there's an antenna that is wired through the belt loops that are in the back. So if lightning strikes, I am the most likely candidate here to be hit. Now, on this transmitter, there are two switches. The one switch turns the power on, and that switch is turned on early in the morning, and that switch is left on until either I'm finished or the battery runs out, whichever comes first. And then the other switch works the microphone. So if I turn that on, you really can't hear too much of all that are listening to this. And so one of the things that I do after I get all wired and all set is I make sure that the microphone switch is shut off. And the only time it is turned on is when I stand here at this pulpit and when I'm speaking to people. Now, there are a lot of reasons why that's done. The primary reason relates to my singing, and the concern of the people who make these decisions here is that if the microphone is left on and there's some mistake is made that you know, that I will be heard over the public address system, which is a partial concern in this room, but it is a great concern for the people that are out in the hallway who can't hear you, and they would only be able to hear me, and it would cut attendance in the next service. There are a lot of complicated issues that are tied into that. So it's that, and it's also that I talk to a lot of people after the service or in the hallways or at the door, and I've discovered over the years that there are people who are involved in conversation with me, and they're telling me all kinds of things, and suddenly their voices drop, and they say, "Is that on?" And it's either that they're afraid that they're being broadcast over a public address system, or they think that we have someone with a cassette tape in a room down in the basement who is recording all of these conversations, and I'm wired in order to get that. So I make sure that it's off. And I come in, and I sit down in a chair like this, and I don't want you to watch me in future weeks, so this is just for this morning, okay? So I sit down here, and the switch is off. And then during, like this morning, the offering this before the sermon, when your attention is on the drums and the brass and all that other stuff, I reach back here, and I turn the switch on. And then I look at John, who's sitting back there, and he's already this morning a little bit disturbed with me fooling around the switches and tapping the microphone. And I usually ask him a question or say something to him. And he wears headphones. So he is the only one who can hear what I have to say. And I said to him this morning, "Can you hear me?" And he nods. I mean, sometimes he smiles, sometimes he waves. These different things. But the way that I know that the words that I speak are getting through is that he gives me some kind of a response, because I can't hear him back. So it is only the response that he gives that enables me to understand that my message has been communicated. Now, that is precisely the concept that is being communicated here in this verse. The way that God knows that his words have gotten through to us is that we respond. If there's no response, then the assumption is that his word has not been communicated. If someone says, "I know God," and there's no response, then that person's a liar. Because the response is the way that we tell that the command has gotten through. Now, does this mean then that the only person who is a Christian is someone who is perfect? Someone who hears every word and obeys every command? No, it doesn't mean that, for we know that failure to obey a few commands does not mean that we are not Christians. But we also know that someone who switches God off, someone who doesn't listen, someone who ignores his commands just outright or deliberately disobeys them, they have all the signs then, in fact, of being someone not connected to God and not really knowing him. Well, let's suppose that we want to test our circuits here. What would be some things that we could check out for ourselves to test the circuitry of our relationship to God when we say that we know him? Well, let's run a few tests. The first test, I know everybody's going to pass, so that's a good one to begin with. The Bible commands that Christians gather together with other Christians, and that, of course, is called the church. So since you're here this morning, you did okay. You passed everybody that's here, passed that test. Another commandment that is given to us is that we remember what Jesus Christ did in his coming, that is, in his incarnation, and in his sacrifice, that is, his death, through the bread and the cup of communion, which we, in a few minutes, will do. So those who obey that command, that is another test of the circuit, an obedience to the word that God has given. But there are many other circuit tests that we can make. We are commanded to love. Do we love other people? That is, do we behave in a way that is in their best interest? Do we love even our enemies? Do we forgive? Forgive even our enemies and those who again and again have sinned against us. And what about our honesty? God is a God of truth, and he commands us to be persons of truth. Do we speak the truth? That's a circuit test. Or how about worship? We understand that we, as human beings, have an essential need and an invariable practice of worship. There is no question whether we worship or not. The question is who we worship and what we worship. We are told in the Bible that we are commanded to worship God with all of our hearts, with all of our minds, with all of ourselves. If instead we worship a job or a relationship or money or some possession instead of God, then that would be a failure of the test of the circuitry of our relationship with God being connected to Him and knowing Him. If we say we know Him, but we do not do what He commands, then we are liars, and the truth is not in us. The positive example is in verse 5. But if anyone obeys His word, God's love is truly made complete in him. There are lots of people like that. I know far more of those than I would ever want to take the time of accumulating such a list, for it would be so lengthy. People who genuinely love God and obey Him, and God's love grows inside of them. Now again, they are not perfect people, but they are ones who love God and who desire to obey. They want to walk as Jesus walks. They want to live as the Bible teaches. And they work on it. They work on it all the time. But I think that there is a special evidence of this. And that is that the driving priority of the life of the person illustrated in this verse is someone who seeks to obey God independent of circumstances and who sees the circumstances of either pleasure or pain both as opportunities to live out obedience to the commands of God. So for the person who has life that is sweet, I mean, everything is going great. There's good health, there's good money, there's good relationships. Everything is really good. That's not what's most important in that person's life. What's most important is walking as Jesus would walk when things are sweet. It is the person who obeys the commands even if they seem to have everything. They're not trying to bribe God. It is because they know Him that they desire to obey Him. However, if the circumstances switch from sweet to sour, if health is lost, if money disappears, if unemployment replaces a good job, if relationships that have been close break apart, the person is not primarily driven by that circumstance, but primarily driven by a desire to know God and to respond to God's word in his or her life. So the most important thing is not the pain or the pleasure, the sweetness or the sourness. The most important thing is God and how we live out our relationship to Him through whatever these circumstances may be. When the Christian does that, in this positive example, God's love is truly made complete. In other words, God's love grows and matures and becomes increasingly evident and effective in that person's life. I understand that one of the major problems in modern medicine is noncompliance by patients in taking prescribed drugs. And so a lot of surveys are done, and that's a concern to the medical profession, for there are people who will go with some presenting problem to a physician's office, be correctly diagnosed, and the malady may be treated and in fact cured by some medicine. And so the physician writes a prescription. However, there are significant numbers of people who, after they have gone through all of this, don't have the prescription filled. They tuck it in pocket or purse, or they throw it away, or they never get around to it, but they never take advantage of the prescription that has been offered, nor follow its instruction. There are also significant numbers of people who will have the prescription filled but never take the pills. And then, I think most common of all, there are people who, because they don't feel well and because they trust the physician and believe they have been properly diagnosed, have the prescription filled and start taking the medication and then stop when they feel better rather than completing the course, which again is noncompliance. Because while they may be able to subdue the bacterial infection because of the taking of an antibiotic, they may not be able to kill that bacteria without taking the full course of the medicine that has been offered. That means, then, that full health is available, but that they don't take advantage because of that noncompliance. I believe that's comparable to the concept that is here being taught in the beginning of 1 John 2:5. That as we follow the prescriptions of God by obedience, that the love of God increasingly grows within us. It is admittedly a long process, But there is something of a cumulative and building effect of the love of God within us as we comply with the prescription that he has given to us. When we fail to fully comply, then we begin to miss out on the full spiritual health and the benefits of the love of God that he gives to us to take place in our lives. If anyone obeys his word, God's love is truly made complete in him. Now, I find here what I think to be not only fascinating teaching, but powerful practical truth. The question comes, what do we do with it? And my recommendation is that we take this teaching as an opportunity for now to test our circuits, to test the circuits of our own connection with God. That each of us check that connection and see whether the words that come up on the screen result in behavior in our lives. And what if the test fails? What if we discover that we have been saying all the right words, but in truth, there has not been an obedience that has proven out the validity of the connection? Or we have discovered that the connection is weak and shaky at very best. Then it seems to me that that is precisely the time that we ought to make a list, either on paper or on the chalkboard of our minds, a list, a checklist of what we resolve to do, and make a commitment to God that we will begin, here and today, obeying the commands in the areas of our lives where we are disobedient, to ensure that the connection is true, and then to discover the wonder of the love of God growing in us to the point that it is complete. Father, for us I pray that as we test the circuits of our relationship with you, that you will be gracious to us in telling us the honest truth, that we may not be liars nor deceived, for we know that you want us to have that connection. Lord, deliver us from being speakers of words only. May we not be 20th century Gnostics, but may we be 20th century Christians who not only have the right information, but also do the right things. May we not only hear the commands, but may we obey the commands. And may it be a self-evident truth when we say, we know God, that indeed we do. And may your love grow in us to completion for Jesus' sake.